Hey, everybody. Happy Friday. This is Trevin McGee with the Scene Stealers podcast, and I'm sitting here with Eric Moline, Trey Hawk, and a couple of new people that I'd like them to introduce themselves.
Adam Brumbeck.
Claire Rock.
All right. We got two
new
contributors.
They know how to project. That's awesome.
Isn't it great? That's what they teach the kids in school these days.
Is it?
Yeah, it's part of it.
Projection.
Exactly. Well, we're here today to talk about a single movie. Actually, Eric's going to talk about it. We're going to ask him questions. He saw Snow White and the Huntsman.
Yeah, I prefer a Q&A format for this review,
okay.
Please.
All right. Are you going to have to plead the fifth at any point?
Or? I might.
Yeah.
I might have
okay.
to, yeah.
So we're going to talk about that starting off, and then we're going to launch into a question.
A ponderance.
We're gonna each share one of our favorite movies that no one else likes and make a case for why it's misunderstood. And if you stick around for that, you should definitely add your own misunderstood movie in the comments section and let us know, because that's the fun thing about the internet is everyone has an opinion and can share it now, like us. So Eric, let's get started.
Okay,
let's get started with Joe with the Snow White.
Hold on, let me get into character. I'm going to play the part of Rupert Holmes.
Okay.
Well, hold it. No, that's the.
It's not Rupert Murdoch either.
That's the Pina Colada song. Rupert Sanders.
Rupert Sanders.
I'm the director.
Okay.
Of Snow White and the Huntsman. This is my first feature film.
Okay.
I've directed lots of MTV music videos and commercials.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very excited.
They still make
to
music videos?
I don't know. I don't know that much about myself.
Okay.
You know. But I'm here to answer any questions you
just
have
meant
about
in general.
The
they still make like
oh,
music,
I think
music
yeah
videos
for YouTube. There's this network called YouTube.
They send
have
the YouTube.
You ever seen Vivo?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Vivo
yeah.
on YouTube. That's,
that's
the
like the
MTV.
Home of mainstream.
So they
music videos.
So if I understand YouTube right, you have an idea for a video, and then you call YouTube. And they decide if it's a good idea and then come out to your house and film it? Is
exactly.
that right?
That's, yeah. that's
okay.
completely
they
correct.
They send out a full production crew.
Right. All right.
They pay for everything.
Yep. It's okay. So great.
I've got this idea. I'm going to try and sing this song and jump up on this coffee table, and it's going to come right out from under me, and I'm going to hurt myself really bad.
Or, hey, I'm going to get all my friends together, and we're going to pretend we're having sex with this ottoman.
Okay.
Would yeah. you guys come out and videotape this, YouTube?
Right.
I was gonna smack right. my forehead on the table in front of me.
Right.
As I'm like booty shaking.
Okay, me and my friend, we have this idea. All right, it involves a cup and
no.
shitting.
No.
Yeah, Eric, you may just have to actually review this, because I don't know that the
you
four
guys
of
had
us
all these questions about
back.
This movie
we're
before we started,
Rupert,
and now
I,
that we're actually
I,
taping.
All right,
no
I've got a question.
Miss, yeah,
I got a question.
Yes,
I was. Okay. I have so sort of the same question. I only care about Kristen Stewart.
Yeah,
Kristen Stewart's in the movie.
did she just bite her lips and do this with her fingers through her hair the whole time?
Let's just say that Kristen Stewart doesn't show a whole lot more than what she shows in the Twilight series. And as a constant Kristen Stewart apologist,
mm-hmm.
because I love the movie Adventureland and I love the movie The Runaways,
yeah.
and I thought she was a great Joan Jett,
yeah.
I was, I'm breaking character already.
Yeah.
I'm Eric Moline again. I was horrified to find out that she was going to resort to all the same shit she does in the Twilight movies, because the way that I used to defend her as an actress was by telling people it's appropriate for the films.
Right.
But
she's
now she's in this
more.
Snow White movie,
Twilight.
And it's not appropriate for this movie. Yes, it's a darker movie. They're trying to do like this Grimm's fairy tale thing,
uh-huh.
right, where they plug all the known entities of Snow White and the legend into this medieval mm-hmm. kind of Ridley Scott kind of generic medieval nightmare,
mm-hmm.
and she's supposed to, everyone's walking around talking about how beautiful she is and how she radiates and in the kingdom, and she's this special person, and there is zero evidence of it
her
on
eyes
screen.
Are just dead.
What's that?
Her eyes are just dead.
Her eyes are dead. Her mouth doesn't do much. I mean,
she
it's
just bites her lips.
It's all the yeah, it's all the things that people always said, and I used to go, you know, that's what she's doing in this series.
Right. Yeah,
but apparently that's what she thought she should have done
that's
in this
her,
movie
maybe
as
that's
well.
Her default mode.
That's
maybe you
default.
Should stick with your original premise and say, as a director, I have no idea how to get good performances out of my actresses.
Ooh.
So she slid back into automatic hairbrush mm-hmm. lip
so
bite mode.
There you go.
On DVD, it can be a drinking game, like all of her movies.
So I'm going to let you
sure.
I'm going to let you translate. I'm going to let you translate for me,
cuz okay,
I can't do this anymore.
So now I'm the director.
Yeah. You're the director. So I'll give the review and then you'll say why.
Okay. This is a disaster.
Trey, what was your question, sir?
Well, I don't know that I have a question. Except, I mean, it might be.
The movie could be great. I'm just talking about one performance.
I reviewed, or not reviewed, but I went and watched a number of your short films, Mr. Sanders. Mm-hmm. And I thought that, you know, it was just sort of the same dark, hard, you know, with moments of hard light, mm-hmm. Shallow depth of field, mm-hmm. Edgy content, like edgy images with no content underneath them. So naked woman walking around a kitchen, and she happens to have a long prehensile tail.
Yeah.
And it's like, ooh, where the hell did this person come from? Because my roommate must have brought this crazy woman back there. Mm-hmm. And later on, I might throw in a sex scene where I'm having sex with this woman doggy style.
What was the question?
And I remove her prehensile tail. Anyway, it's just one of those. It seems like, it was an animal. Yeah, good. But anyway, Rupert Sanders seems to rely on what seems like an interesting idea, interesting visual idea, but then builds up no content underneath it. So, like, you get this impactful visual that you're like, oh, that's kind of interesting. And then it just, over the course of 10 or 12 minutes in the short film, you're like, I am bored to death. You know, it's like, yeah, okay, so seeing the liquid metal.
I think
metal,
there was a question.
All right,
there.
So no seeing question. The liquid no metal mirror in the trailer, seeing the fact that Charlize Theron bursts into like lots of crows, and seeing that some of
that was cool.
That there, yeah. I mean, it seems like there are some interesting visuals, but having seen his short films, do they fall flat? Is there not enough content underneath the visuals to hold it up?
Well, yes.
There is enough.
No, there's not.
There's not.
No,
yes.
It falls flat.
I made the right choice.
Next question. Well, you pretty much said everything for me, right?
Okay, great.
Yeah, that's true about all of that stuff.
Let's keep the...
So see his short films. They will save you a whole bunch of time.
Yeah, the special effects, there's a couple good scenes in the movie where Charlize Theron does turn into a bunch of crows and vice versa. Mm-hmm.
Become Charlize Theron?
Yeah, it's true. There's two or three moments like that that happen in the film where you're like... It kind of jogs you out of your boredom, because the movie itself is so dull. Mm-hmm. That's the word. When I came out, and the publicist says, you know, we'd like to know what you thought, so we can send your quotes back to the studio.
You just made a fart sound.
No, I just dull. I just said it's just dull,
you mean,
and
like,
it kept going. I don't know if it's 2 hours or what. It felt like forever. Because what they do is they start this series of events in motion that have nothing to do with each other. Except that every now and then they remind you of something of the Snow White legend. So we have the apple, right? We have the mirror. We have the seven dwarfs, who, by the way...
Dwarves.
Yeah, dwarves. Sorry, excuse me. Well, no insult to dwarves anywhere, but the dwarves used in this movie were CGI'd versions of real-sized actors.
Okay. Real-sized.
Like, yeah. Of Eddie Marzan.
Isn't that
Nick Frost. Ray Winstone. Ian McShane from Deadwood.
McShane?
Yeah.
And
Bob Hoskins.
I knew Hoskins.
In a reveal that is so ridiculous, he's wearing like this bird mask, and then he takes it off, and he's the last one to speak, and everyone's like, yay, it's Bob Hoskins.
It's like Eyes Wide Shut. Great.
Yeah.
Is there a key party at any point?
No, there was no key party. But here's the thing. Once those dudes get on screen, all of a sudden the movie actually has something going for it. Like for the first time, an hour into the film, you feel like, oh, okay, there's people who can engage my interest at this point.
Right.
Because this movie is so fucking flat. I mean, it really, there's nothing to it at all. It's complete eye candy. And like I said
here's
earlier,
the question.
It's nothing you haven't seen before. So it's just kind of, it just wears on you after a while.
So here's a question that's a short question.
Yeah.
You mentioned that he's a visual director, and you just talked about how dull he is. Does the dullness, is it a result of a flat script that doesn't work? Is it the result of some choppy editing that just doesn't create tension or work?
It's mostly the script.
So as a director, he's able to make some compelling visuals. It's just without a decent story to back it.
Now I wouldn't say compelling.
Well.
Go and see his short films. It's on him.
I wouldn't say compelling. It's
you
not
really just
want to
hate
on
him, Trey.
You
just really
yeah, I watched
hate
a whole bunch of his short films.
Well, here's the deal.
Okay.
He owes me that time back. Background.
This movie was written by John Lee Hancock,
okay,
who is the director of The Blind Side and The Alamo.
Right.
It was co-written by the guy who wrote Drive. Hossein Amini. And then Evan Dougherty is a newcomer who came up with the original story and also has a co-credit. So I'm assuming that the other two guys did some sort of, you know.
So really they should have just let Refn take this film and then it could have been awesome.
This is just one of those movies where somebody has the high concept and they say, we're going to do Snow White and we're going to do it dark and we're going to do it medieval.
Uh-huh.
And because people like those kind of movies, they'll go see it because they're suckers, and that's
like
all
Snow
it means.
White in medieval times.
Yeah,
is that what it is?
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I was going to see if we could like raise the spoiler alert so we could actually talk about.
Are there spoilers in this?
I just want to hear more about the actual story itself, I guess.
Yeah. So basically, it's a quest, right? Snow White has to she escapes from the queen's lair,
uh-huh,
and because she's had her up there since she took over the throne, and the huntsman goes after her, and they gradually form
John
a respect
huntsman.
For each other, mm-hmm, and they uh-huh come upon all sorts of people in their adventures, including the seven dwarfs,
mm-hmm,
and then they're all kind of journeying towards a moment that they don't really know. Like, nobody really knows what it is, but we know it's all going to come together and they're going to end up fighting the queen at the end.
Here's a question. When she has to armor up before she goes into
yes
Snow White battle,
yes,
do woodland creatures put her armor on for her?
No.
Because I would actually...
Actually, there's one... The other scene,
yeah,
besides
I want it to look
crows,
like, I want it to
scene,
look like the Iron Man getting his armor
yeah
on,
yeah,
but instead
no
of robots,
little
it's
birds,
woodland
little
creatures
birds
yeah
and chipmunks, like,
there
putting
is,
her gauntlets on.
There is a scene
on
in the forest with her and the creatures,
uh-huh,
and there's two of them. There's one where the forest, it's the dark forest, and everything's going crazy.
Oh, shit, yeah.
No, and it's actually kind of cool. There's some surreal moments where they make the ground below her come alive, and the camera's rocking back and forth while she can't stand on it. And it's
uh-huh
actually really well done and kind of creepy. And then later there's a scene where all the animals come to her, and that's broken up by one of them getting a arrow shot in the side. So
oh
it's like, what?
Whoa.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's not cool. Like, there's no... I was just like, uh-huh, okay, that was... interesting,
it's
I guess.
Cool.
But no, it's literally there's nothing going on in this film. It's a crass commercialization
uh-huh
of people saying, oh, that we want to see some stupid familiar story, just like Alice in Wonderland by Tim
yeah
Burton, where she puts on the armor and she goes into battle. I mean,
I hated that movie. God, I hated
it's
that
just
movie.
It's just not everything around everything surrounding it is a product. There's
well,
no
and it seems
it
like
exist.
They watched the 1937 Snow White and were like, okay, how can we make every opposite choice possible to this film?
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's the film that Eisenstein said is the best film ever made.
Well, this one is certainly devoid of charm.
Good.
So.
Yeah.
This is not the best film ever
yeah
made.
This is not. No. Sergei Eisenstein hates this
film. I'm giving it a rock
you know,
fist way down.
Way
it's
down.
It's one of my least favorite movies of the year, and I just saw This Means War the other night on Blu-ray, so...
Nice.
Yeah.
McG, so you rated this below a McG movie.
Well, not exactly.
Okay.
They're both two
pretty
of the
abysmal
worst films I've
pretty
seen
abysmal
in recent memory,
yeah,
and they just happened to be the last two I saw.
Okay.
So
right.
I really need to see something good to cleanse my palate.
Let's move on. I'm sorry. Maybe you should watch one of your misunderstood movies since you're already talking. Why don't you go ahead and tell us?
Well, I've talked a lot, so I'm going to defer to Claire. What's your
oh,
what's your
Claire
misunderstood
Claire
right out of the gate?
Mic up.
Hey,
yep.
What's my misunderstood movie? Mine is one that probably nobody's ever heard of called Four Eyed Monsters. Have you heard of it?
No.
Really?
Which one?
Four Eyed Monsters.
Four. Oh yeah, I've seen Four Eyed Monsters.
Yeah.
It's
my favorite film ever.
That's your favorite film ever?
Yes.
Wow, that is a bold statement. That is
well,
a huge statement.
That Girl Interrupted.
Okay. Wow.
I
all
have
right
a really like. My favorite movies are like not because they're great movies. It's mainly just because they make me feel happy.
You know, the thing I liked the best about Four Eyed Monsters was the making of Four Eyed Monsters.
Yeah.
I thought the movie itself was just kind of average.
Well, the reason that I like the movie that I have found it, like, the reason that I consider it one of my favorites is because it goes from the movie and, like, morphs itself into this documentary about the making of the movie. And it's, like, so perfectly done. It's, like, seamless. And that is, like, the main reason I love that movie. It's
so you should
so good.
You should explain it a little bit, since I think most people won't know what it is.
Well, it's directed by Aaron Crumley and Susan Boyce. I don't know how to say her last name. But Aaron Crumley is actually a filmmaker. and it's about these two people. It's a true story about Aaron and Susan, how they met online. And Aaron's kind of like this loser guy who like doesn't have girlfriends. And doesn't have girlfriends and stuff. I'm terrible at talking into the microphone. And so they just like meet online and they create this whole relationship. And it starts out really weird. But they go on all these really weird dates and like try to find ways to keep this relationship creative. And then the relationship totally dies. But they decide to make a movie about it. And it's really cool because they like in the relationship, it looks like you're watching this narrative film about their movie, about their relationship, and then it just becomes a documentary about how they decided to make this movie about their relationship and how the documentary actually kills the relationship even more.
Have you seen Catfish?
No.
It's kind of like Catfish in that you think that this is going to be a movie about this guy who meets these interesting people throughout the way and then falls in love with a girl online, and then what it turns out to be is this movie about these guys who made this conscious decision at one point when they figured out something was wrong with this girl online to make the movie about that. And then, and Four-Eyed Monsters has the same deal where there's not a lot of footage at the beginning.
Yeah.
But once they make the decision to start filming, they're narrating old stuff and going back and telling that information. Yeah. So the film gets a lot richer because there's that. But then you also feel
it's
like...
It's slow to start off. It's just kind of like, what is this? It's
yeah. But then you feel like, at least I felt like it was, there was so much there was too much self-reflection in it. Like, I felt like the only reason that we are getting to know why their relationship fell apart is because they know they're going to film it and they think it's going to be a good movie.
Yeah.
And that kind of put me off a little bit. You know what I mean? I think so. But there was this whole campaign surrounding it that was really interesting. I mean, yeah. The thing that it's really known for is how it galvanized this fan base online, right?
Yeah, it was because it was the first like feature-length film showed on YouTube, and they did have like all of this like street promotion that they did, and like they did screenings in Second Life, and they did all of this stuff and went totally broke just to promote this one movie that they thought was going to be awesome. I think that's part of the reason that I love it so much is because they put so much into it, and it's not like that great of a film, but there's just so much behind it. There's so much like heart in it.
So for you, it's like the whole experience. Yeah. It's not just
because
the movie.
Even after the movie was over, they still made podcasts for like a year or two. And it was just like this ongoing thing.
And they're
like,
broken up. They didn't get back together.
Yeah, they don't even talk at all. It's weird. But yeah, like every now and then they still do screenings.
It's familiar.
I just recently saw something like maybe a few months ago about how they did a screening. And they, like, always get the question, like, oh, are you guys back together? No.
Yeah.
No, cool. I want to talk about Catfish.
Catfish.
Have you seen Catfish?
Yeah, I love.
Yeah. I gave it a really good review. It's a great movie, like, for what it is. Now, how much of it is true or not is, and at what point their intentions cloud the movie that they're trying to presenting, uh-huh. That's still up for grabs. And there's an interesting lawsuit. I don't think this has been resolved yet. But there's a clause in the contract. This is a movie about the guys who had the girl and met her on Facebook, and they said it was a documentary. But it may not be a documentary because they may have staged a bunch of things in it. But there's a lawsuit, and the lawsuit is that there's a woman's. The crux of the movie is that this woman's song is played on YouTube, or is played in a message that he gets from her, and he finds that song on YouTube. Because it's not hers.
Right.
It's another artist's. Well, the company that put this out, is it Weinstein?
I think so.
I think it was Weinstein. They didn't pay that artist to use the song in the movie because it was a documentary.
Oh.
If the movie is not a documentary, they owe her some sort of money for rights to the song.
Sure.
But as a piece of incidental music in a documentary, she doesn't have to, or no, she signed off on something, I think, saying that she wouldn't get paid because of that. Yeah. So if that turns out not to be true in the court case, if they find that it isn't a documentary, whatever that means anymore, right?
Yeah.
Then that will be a rule, and that will be in the law books that Catfish is not a documentary.
Wow. Well,
I think that's kind of the cool thing about Catfish, though. But we can talk. I mean,
well, do you want to? Are we just going to go around the table?
Yeah.
So we should go to another one because I know we don't want to spend a million years talking about Catfish. But yeah. We have a bunch of stuff on Scene Stealers about it. So look it up. There's a really good article that I did a bunch of research on it and put it up. So
ton of research.
So who's next?
Around the clock.
Adam, yeah. Are you up next?
We're going counterclockwise.
Sure. To the people who can't see how we're sitting.
Okay. I was really racking my brain on this one because I feel like I like movies that people like typically. Mm-hmm.
Nothing wrong with that.
Like, what?
So there's nothing wrong with that.
Oh, yeah. Well, or that, like, have gotten acclaim or whatever. I think the one I've settled on at the moment is Winter Passing. Have you guys ever watched Winter Passing?
Is this the one with Will Ferrell?
Yeah. Will Ferrell. Well, okay. So it's about this strung out. I think she's an actress from New York City, and her father lives somewhere in the Northeast, and he's this famous writer that's kind of down on his luck, and his wife has died, and he's just living alone in this house, so she thinks. And a publisher has offered her a huge amount of money for these love letters between him and his wife.
Who's the actress?
It says it stars Zooey Deschanel and Ed Harris, but that's actually, I don't believe that Zooey Deschanel is the main actress. I think she's who she lives with. Or who
is it? Deidre O'Connell? Is her name Deidre?
There's Amelia Warner, Amy Madigan.
Amelia Warner.
It is Amelia Warner? Okay. Yep. So Amelia Warner plays this strung out actress or performer in New York City. And so she goes back to get these letters so she can give them to the publisher so she can make all this money off of her dad. She goes home and she finds that her dad has taken in these two kind of nobodies taking care of him. And Will Ferrell is just one of the stay-in housemates at this point. And her father lives in the shed in the back. But it's kind of this story of her trying to reconnect with her father, and she lives with them for a while and gets to know these two people that are living with him. And it's kind of her accepting that they've taken her role as the like offspring of this loser dad who was once this great writer.
So what about it like just strikes a chord with you? And
I guess I just like it because it's kind of just this, it's sort of this sad, mundane kind of life that they're all living, but then there's aspects of humor in it. Like Will Ferrell is this guy that wants to be a rock star, and he like wears eyeliner around the house to look really cool, and he just kind of lightens it up a little bit. I don't know. I guess I just like it because of the kind of mellow mood of the whole thing. You know, it
like
makes you kind of
sad and mellow.
Yeah, sad and mellow. Yeah, I mean, that's probably, I think, why I really like it. But the whole story is pretty interesting to me. She goes back, and it's her finding the letters and also hating the fact that these two people are living in the house she grew up in that she doesn't want anything to do with. The dad's totally crazy. He put his wife's bedroom furniture out on the lawn in the way that it was in the bedroom that she died in, which is kind of weird. Yeah, but the main actress, she's like self-mutilating, so she's always like breaking her fingers and weird stuff like that. So,
crazy.
Yeah, it's all over the place.
Have you seen this? Okay.
Is it on Netflix?
I don't know.
No, it's not on Instant.
Yeah, because I kind of want to see this now.
Yeah,
it's like the one, I mean, Will Ferrell got a lot of attention for Stranger Than Fiction as being mm-hmm. sort of different than what he was usually doing. This is even more so than that, and it got some attention for that because it's a straight-up serious role. There's not much comedic to it. The eyeliner thing is the funniest element to his character. And yeah, it's an interesting film. I've seen it. But yeah, I don't know if I come down as interested as you are in it just because it's, I don't know. It's kind of a hard movie to process. It's mm-hmm. not like too dark, but it has some. I had some issues with it.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, it's Trey's turn now.
All right.
Speaking of issues, it's Trey's turn.
Yes.
I was thinking about you while I was watching Snow White and the Huntsman. By the way,
you were.
Yeah, I was thinking about you and how you didn't like the Avengers, and I was thinking you would really hate this movie.
Oh yeah.
At least the Avengers had charm. Anyway, go ahead.
Sure. all right. So I'm struggling between two, and I've made my decision, but I wanted to just, like, the film that I would normally pick for this, which I am not going to pick,
would be Dune, David Lynch's Dune. It's a film that, for some reason, I just watch it over and over and over again. And
that's a great pick because it's universally hated.
Yeah.
What's the
film
pick you
goers,
want to do?
Filmgoers hate
it. I'm going to push you towards one of the other.
I think you'll be just as pleased with my other one.
What do we got here?
The other one that I really want to pick, because it is almost universally hated also, is The Cell.
So
I'll let you choose. I mean, I can talk about either one.
I haven't seen either of them in about the same time.
Okay.
Which is since The Cell was in the theaters.
I like Dune. I do not care for The Cell.
Okay,
so
then I'll do The Cell.
Okay.
Because that's the one that I thought I would do.
But I don't like
Dune
Carson.
Dune has some cult buildup, like some cult following now.
Speaking of music video directors.
Yeah.
Exactly. Tarsim Singh. And the thing that made me kind of choose The Cell is that recently I rewatched The Fall.
Yeah.
And
where
I
do you come down on The Fall?
What?
How do you?
I thought The Fall was good. I thought The Fall was really good.
I love
good.
The Fall.
I know you. We fought about it because I don't like it. I don't like Tarsim at all. I think he's a shit director.
Eric and I saw The Cell together.
Uh-huh.
Oh my God, did we?
We
on
did.
Tour?
We were on tour.
Holy crap!
So Eric and I saw The Cell together, and I remember that you, Bill, and Nick all just hated The Cell, and there was something about it that I just kind of stayed quiet. Because I do think that there are some big flaws with it, but Tarsim.
Let's do a little setup.
All right,
just so they know what we're talking about.
It's Jennifer Lopez,
right?
And
so far,
Vince
so
Vaughn.
Good.
Vince Vaughn
in a dramatic role,
right? Are CIA operatives or FBI agents?
Yeah, they're special agents
of some sort.
Yeah,
and they're trying to track down a serial killer
played by Vincent D'Onofrio, right?
Right. And so they
the part
catch
he was
him,
born to play.
They catch
every
him
serial
and,
killer,
and they catch him in some scientist, like some therapist, psychotherapist, allows them to kind of enter his
brain.
Yeah,
they basically put him in a brain chamber, and it's an excuse
for
Tarsim.
Sci-fi. It's basically this crazy sci-fi killer.
It's really just an excuse for Tarsim to do really weird.
And that's kind of my point. And I at least appreciate your consistency. If you don't like Tarsim's gadgetry,
right,
like his hijinks at figuring out a way to be able to switch from real world to his crazy visionary world, then that's great.
He's a really visual director. It's just that the visuals he create, I'm never really compelled by. I find The Fall the least offensive of his movies, but I think he's just super. I think all of his movies are incredibly pretentious, with very little underneath the visuals. Especially after watching Immortals and seeing and I haven't seen his Snow White movie because he made one earlier this year too. But after watching Immortals, I was like, yeah, that's all he's good at. Like that's it. He can make a pretty picture.
You know, my one thing with The Cell that I really do think it's a fundamental flaw and something that I think a lot of people have real problems with is the fact that he needed some sort of bookend some sort of structure to lay over so that he could explain his just totally out there, you know, like aim for the, you know, like shoot for the moon.
Right. So admittedly, the script is kind of crappy.
Yeah. But the thing is in rewatching The Fall, you know, I don't think that script is that great either. I mean, you've got kind of this bizarre English patient structure to it.
It really is, yeah.
It really is.
There's something truthful and soulful about The Fall The Cell doesn't have. Or
you know what it is? It's the it's the performance of the.
I know that The Fall, sorry to interrupt here, but I know that The Fall is definitely on Netflix Instant, so you can check that out. Don't break your back trying to find anything. Definitely don't spend any money trying to find Immortals or
The Fall. But The Fall, the reason why I think The Fall wins and The Cell doesn't is that The Fall has that incredible performance from that young actress.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So back to The Cell, though.
Right.
What is it that you're recommending besides the dream sequences?
J-Lo.
Or the visuals? Because that's what I liked about it the last time.
Right.
But it's just that the method that it was delivered, the script that surrounded it, the reason that we were there to see this story unfold in the first place was so bullshit and so cliched and full of just like all these pretentious moments that Lopez and Vaughn, neither of them, I didn't think could carry it.
Yeah. I mean, and they both totally struggle. I admittedly so. But I think that the reason why I struggle is that I walked out of it and I was like, oh, that was a really interesting take visually. I mean, this is a guy who almost his entire storytelling comes through the visuals, mm-hmm. and the script is in almost every single one of his films an afterthought. And I don't think he's gotten it right yet in any of his films. But I just really am impressed by anybody who's just like, I'm going to tell this story visually. He embraces the visual of, you know, the visuals of a visual medium. And I think that that deserves some respect, even if, admittedly, the script and the structure that surrounds it is less than adequate. It's not great. But it is just, I mean, the Fall has some problems with the script also. The Fall is very contrived as far as the story that surrounds the crazy visuals. So to me, it's like you either have to some extent, embrace both or to some extent condemn both.
No, I don't agree with that.
I mean,
at all.
You don't have to, and that's fine. But I feel like in watching The Fall again, I was like, why did everybody hate The Cell so much? Because I saw some of the same contrivances in The Fall. You think it's just J-Lo and J-Lo. Vince Vaughn? It could be J-Lo and Vince Vaughn.
It was right around the time, the great J-Lo backlash of 97.
Yeah.
Or whenever that J-Lo. Stupid movie came
2000.
Out. 2000.
Yeah. I think that you may be onto something, and that maybe the fact that there were unknown actors in The Fall helped it. I think also the fact that he has a reason for telling the story the way he does in The Fall. And in The Cell, it's just this thing that they go into, and it doesn't make any sense.
It's totally contrivance.
Yeah. And in the Fall, I think the fact that that it's a story that he's telling.
Yeah, he's telling a fairy tale.
And that they have these things that make sense in the real world, and they have a bigger meaning in the story that he's telling. I think that makes it a little more poignant and a little bit a lot more poignant. I really love The Fall. I understand it's pretentious, but you're talking to a guy who loves Terrence Malick. So
saying it's pretentious. There are contrivances.
That's my big argument.
Yeah, there are contrivances in the story, even as he's telling the story, that it's like, oh, all right, here's our way out, you know.
Well, you look at every movie he does, and there's some mechanic there that gives him an out or gives him an excuse to go nuts with the visuals. You
sure.
know, even in The Fall, like the stories that he's telling, because the premise of The Fall is there's a guy in a hospital, and there's a little young girl that's a ward there, too. And he tells her a series of kind of fairy tales to get her to... Some of it's related to what happened to him in real life. Some of it's to get her to do something for him. And there's a little more to it than that, but that's like the 30-second summary. Anyway, it doesn't explain why when he describes these stories, she visualizes them in such a like meticulous and ornate, crazy way. I mean, it really is just an excuse for Tarsem to make
these... We don't nitpick Princess Bride that way.
I do. I hate that movie, too.
Wow. Yes! Mr. Consistency, Trevin McGee, nice.
I hate Princess Bride. Thank you.
Wow.
Thank you.
All right, fair enough.
Claire and Adam were sad that they weren't a part of the podcast that Warren was a part of, the movie that you hate that you don't get.
Anyway. Yeah.
I'm not a fan of Princess
Bride. I don't get it.
Well,
we
spent a lot of time on The Cell. I think there's a reason to go back, especially if you've really found yourself loving The Fall. Go back and rewatch The Cell. I think there's going to be more in there to mine out of than previously thought.
And if you are a fan of really sound visual filmmaking, how's that for a weird oxymoron? Yeah. But really, really great visual filmmaking. I mean, Tarsem.
It's better than saying really visual filmmaking.
Right. So. But he is. That's his strong point. Tarsem Singh is a great visual director for sure. It's just the movies that surround him are shit.
Speaking of visuals,
go ahead, buddy.
And the movies that surround them that everybody hates.
Uh-huh.
My movie that
Tron
I love.
Legacy.
No. What? Why would you? I'm offended that you would even mention that. Because the movie that I love that everybody else hates is so much more high-minded than Tron Legacy.
Of course.
What is more high-minded than Tron Legacy?
Speed Racer.
I was going to say Speed... Oh, man, Speed I'm glad
Racer.
You went.
Oh, I, man, Speed Racer. I am not a fan.
Speed Racer is an amazing fucking movie.
I put it
on my top 10 that year when it came out, and I will defend it to the ends of the earth, and this is why. Well, no, hold it. First of all, I want to hear your criticism of it, because if it's what I think it is, then that's going to be fun.
All right, Adam, why don't you like Speed Racer?
I think I would.
Spotlight on
it. Because there's one basic criticism that everybody has of this movie, and I think it's...
I took it at, like, I guess surface value when I was watching it. And I was just... I felt like it was just this thing to look crazy for me to be appealed, you know? But I was just like... Sorry, I don't care.
So the thing you're kind of going there. What a lot of people said when this movie came out was it was from the Wachowski brothers, the Wachowskis rather. Sorry,
yeah.
Since one of them is now a woman, and they expected after the Matrix films that this was going to be kind of an adult version of Speed Racer or something really cool. Like that, something a little darker. Well, it's not. It is as close to a live action realization of crude Japanese anime as we will ever get. It is as brightly colored and totally insane, just complete visual overload. But then, in addition to that, they kept the same kind of story themes. The really simple story themes about family and about being yourself and not selling out and all that and all those really cheesy little things that the cartoon was based on.
Right.
And they blew it up into this big epic about, you know, this kid who's got this brother that mysteriously disappeared and he's got to live up to his shadow. And then he's a big champion on the racing circuit, and there's a big corporate behemoth that wants to buy him out, and he sticks by his family, and they're the little family that could, and all that kind of stuff. And I don't know what people were expecting out of Speed Racer, but that is like the perfect story for them to do. Now, granted, I will admit it's a little bit too long, but what I really enjoyed about it was that they created something I've never seen on film before, and they called it layered unreality. And what that is instead of making the movie like a 3D film or something like that, what they did was they constructed layers of special effects that could not exist in the same plane. So if you're looking at a frame, and here there's a table and a room, and we're all sitting at chairs, if Trey was sitting in a chair where Claire was, which is at the other end of the room, but he appeared closer, that would be unreality. That's simply not possible. Yeah. And in this movie, they do that all the time.
How they segue between scenes.
All the segues between scenes are amazing, and it's just like they're completely pushing the boundaries of visual storytelling. In other words, we've learned after 100 years of watching commercials and TV shows and movies how to process film. When we're 4 years old, we're seeing cuts that happen right away, and we're realizing, you know, Trey didn't just get small. This is a close-up, or this is a long shot, right? We process that. Well, what they do in this movie is completely fuck with the way that we're supposed to be processing things. And so when there's a fight scene, instead of actually having the people fight each other, they're moving these people around in space and time how people do not actually move. And that the same goes for the races on the race course and everything. Yeah. They do things that are physically not possible. Yeah. And the whole movie is based on that. And I think that a lot of people, like Scott Pilgrim, said, oh, that's stupid. And that is like the worst, most irresponsible level of thought when you go see a movie and you just come out saying something like that. Because you're not processing what they're giving to you at all. Right. You don't understand why it's different. It just doesn't look cool, so it must be stupid. And that was the worst
criticism. That's one way to look at it. But, I mean, don't get me wrong. I love the movie. I own it on Blu-ray. I think it's great.
Blu-ray, it's really amazing.
It's awesome. Yeah, it really is.
Because it's one of the first movies that was actually filmed in 1080p.
Yeah.
And when I saw... It looks
really good.
Not a spoiler alert, but bias alert. I did see a panel at a special effects film festival with some of the people who were on it, and they explained some things, and that was amazing.
Yeah.
But they said this movie is the first movie ever made that will look better on your home theater than it will in the theater because it was filmed that way.
Right. That's awesome.
Yeah.
The only thing I'd say is, I get why people didn't enjoy it, you know, and I don't think it means, you know, anytime you walk out of a movie, especially a movie that costs $84 million or $124 million, and say, that was stupid, they didn't know what they were doing. It's like, well, maybe, maybe they gave a director, you know, like... too much freedom, or an eighth of $1 billion to make a movie, and he didn't know what he was doing, or maybe he did know what he was doing, and he made some intentional choices that you didn't agree with. At the same time, those choices can be really stupid.
Well,
and so some people that can't, because I read some, you know, some people came out of it didn't enjoy it because, you know, it's the plot doesn't really work at times, it's a little long. I mean, I enjoyed it. I get that criticism, but just as a visual experience, and it's just fun, and it feels like a giant cartoon at times, I really enjoyed that aspect of it.
Yeah, I would actually challenge anybody who likes Scott Pilgrim versus the World and has not seen Speed Racer to watch it again, or who has seen it, to watch it again with new eyes. And I think that the comic visual stuff that's happening too, like the slapstick stuff from Scott Pilgrim that we responded to. So there's a ton of that in Speed Racer as well.
I think the difference between the two is that Scott Pilgrim isn't always full throttle with that sort of with that sort of information. Whereas Speed Racer, I felt like I could never escape it. I felt like I was just exhausted.
I felt like Speed Racer had major pacing issues.
I would agree with that.
I mean, and
the entire emotional core of the movie comes down to a montage at the end. Like they sum up everything that's emotionally at stake in a montage.
I think it definitely has some scripting issues,
the whole thing where he's driving and then like
the big reveal.
All of that. Oh. Everything before he crosses the finish line. Okay. Yeah.
But I mean, I think storyline, it's there, but it's because I've seen it a couple of times, I tried to like it because they are doing some impressive visual stuff, really impressive visual stuff, and they're definitely being really decisive with how they handle their visuals and their visual storytelling. So I think, again, it's totally worthwhile to go and see and mine for those kinds of details. But story-wise, it's very light. And I think that if you're going to make a feature-length film...
I wouldn't say light. I would say that it takes something that should be light and they put it onto an epic level.
Okay.
Right? They're making it light they're blowing it up to these huge proportions.
And I would agree with
that. Epic.
But I still don't think... I think there's some pretty big flaws with the story and the plotting, and I definitely think there's some huge problems with the pacing.
Yeah.
I think if they had given us some time, some moments to slow down and to chill out, they could have made those visuals
There are moments like that, but I will say to you guys that those moments are also in bright, bright, bright colors.
Right.
And so even when this movie is slow, it still feels like it's assaulting.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's the thing is that, I mean, I think they could just... You know, sometimes to see how white something is, we need some black there.
Yeah. Right.
And so it's just like, you know, it's same like noirs are a perfect example.
Well, as Donald Trump said, I've always had a good relationship with the blacks.
Exactly. So, you know, what?
What?
But that with noirs, with high-key lighting, you get very bright lights to make very deep shadow.
Right.
And I think that they could have applied some of that, give us a very stark moment, who then really hit us with these incredibly layered amazing
Before movies. I turn this over to Trevin to hear his movie, I'm going to say one last thing, and that is my dream as a filmgoer is to see this movie in 3D. I'm not kidding.
That's your dream?
That is one of my dreams.
You could have
a bigger dream than that.
I really want to see it in 3D. They wanted to make it in 3D, but they ran out of money, and Warner Brothers said, we need to put this out.
Oh, okay.
So
it would have been amazing in 3D.
If it would have made money, there would have been a 3D version on...
I feel like I would have been in an arcade game.
Yeah, but this would have been different. Yeah. That's what I'm saying. This is all these flat images layered.
Yeah, Claire, you were already into it, so this might have been the 3D movie that changed 3D for you ever.
All right, Trevin.
All right.
Oh, man.
We've left you about 3 minutes. Go.
Like Trey, I had a handful that I just love, and it's hard for me to get people to like them or into them at all. And I kind of kept going back to like underrated movies, not necessarily movies that like with Speed Racer. There's a very fervent, you know, group of people that don't like it, and then there's some people that like, oh, I get it, I think it's great, you know. I don't really have anything.
Everybody hates except you.
Everybody hates except me.
Yeah.
That's tough, man.
I'd have to reset.
Well, I was going to say Speed Racer, and you grabbed that one. I don't like, you and I could fight about this one, but I don't like Your Highness enough to say it's one of those, but I do, if it's on TV when I'm channel surfing, I'll watch it, because I think it's really fucking funny at times.
I don't want to choose that for this, though.
No, I don't.
You don't want to defend Your Highness.
No, I don't. Okay. Absolutely not.
That sounded like a threat, Eric, honestly. Like, seriously. You don't want to defend
Walk away,
Your
man.
Highness.
Just walk away.
Not while I'm in the room.
Walk the fuck away, all right? So the one I've got to go to that I just love, and I don't know why more people didn't love it when it came out. I love Walk Hard: The Dewey Cox Story. I think that movie is amazing. I think it's so underrated, and it came out the same time as all those other Jake Kasdan comedies, and like everyone involved went on to do other movies that were successful. And I don't understand why that comedy didn't do better.
I do. Why? And I loved it, by the way.
Why?
I thought it was great, but I've come to love it even more and respect it even more.
Watching
the more
it on
I
DVD,
it.
I mean, I watching the uncut, uncut Cox edition. I love. Anyway, I'll go ahead and then I'll.
There's
explain
a scene
the movie.
Early on in the movie where his brother is killed.
Yeah,
and this
really
is
funny.
This whole movie
really
is
funny.
A,
gets cut
a,
in half with a machete.
Yeah,
hilarious.
This whole movie is a parody of biopics, in particular some of the music biopics that had come out recently, like the Johnny Cash story, Walk the Line, and Ray. So in that scene, which you just described,
yeah.
His brother gets chopped in half with a machete, and what happens?
What do you mean, what happens?
Does candy come out of him?
He's still talking.
Yeah.
He's still talking. So
he says, in fact, I've seen the movie so many times, he said, I'm cut in half real bad, dude. I don't know if I'm going to make it.
Yeah. So the first time you see that, you're not quite sure how to process
so
this
amazing.
Because you're so familiar with these biopics and you're so familiar with the treatment of the characters. And you know this is a parody.
Right.
But you're just not ready for that level of complete over-the-top, like, comedy. And it happens
a
lot in this movie, and I think it just put people off. And then I think what the other reason people don't like it is there's a ton of inside jokes for music fans.
You have to, I think that's a bigger reason than any. But that
I know
makes
a lot of people that say the same thing about Speed Racer that they do about this. Oh, it's stupid. His brother gets cut. It's stupid.
But so that's my favorite criticism. It's stupid.
Are we making fun of our entire fan base now?
Yeah, I'm sure if they say that.
No, they don't. Our fans are the smartest.
If you do, then don't listen to us anymore because I don't want stupid people listening to the podcast.
Whoa, Trevin! I want anybody to listen to us.
That can be edited.
No. No stupid.
Stupid.
No stupid. Walk Hard. Walk Hard is...
I liked it.
Walk Hard is this great... like Eric said, it's a parody of biopics. It's also a parody of... Really, the music industry and a lot of bigger-than-life personalities that music fans are familiar with, including Johnny Cash, Brian Wilson, Bob Dylan, Elvis. And it's so funny. It's just got such a funny heart to it, and it goes on for the entire movie. I can watch that at any point. Any point in the movie is hilarious to me.
The wrong kid died.
You've got Raymond J. Barry, who's on Justified now. He plays Timothy Oliphant's dad.
He did.
Yeah. Well, so he plays, spoiler, I guess, if you haven't seen the third season. but he plays the main character's dad, and he's Dewey Cox's dad. Margot Martindale, also from season two of Justified, she's his mom, Ma Cox and Pa Cox. And it's just hilarious the way Raymond J. Barry plays the Pa character, because, of course, Dewey has to have a daddy issue of some kind. You know, he's got to have something that motivates him. So they just distill him down to saying strictly the wrong kid died. That's pretty much all he says.
That's the best criticism that the movie makes, is that when we enjoy these biopics, that essentially what they're doing is they're taking years and years of conflict and character,
and distilling it down into a character who just says the wrong kid died.
Yeah. And sometimes when you watch biopics, it feels like that.
There's literally a scene when he's working out in the barn, just talking to himself, and he goes, "The wrong kid died." Like he's just like shoveling hay or something and singing to himself. And
we
then,
should also mention this is one of Judd Apatow's first kind of flops.
Yeah,
I mean, it didn't necessarily flop, but it didn't really do that well either.
It didn't
and
do
as a
very
producer.
Well.
Of this movie, he was really on a roll at that point.
Yeah, and you thought, I mean, I thought it was going to be another hit. Jake Kasdan directed it. You know, like you said, it was written by Kasdan and Apatow and produced by Apatow, and then it had a lot of the same Apatow players in it.
But his movies were Knocked Up and A 40-Year-Old Virgin were filled with heart. They were real movies about real people, and yes, they had crazy circumstances.
But there's still heart to this movie. There's still heart to these characters, and there's a lovable nature to a lot of the characters, like Dewey and his band, and then the way they hit all the bullet points of every biopic, like when he descends into drug addiction, like the first time he smokes weed, like he's like, "You don't want any of this shit," and then he's like. The discussion about weed is hilarious. Yeah. He's like, "Oh, will it kill you?" And he's like, "No." He's like, "Well, what's it do? It makes sex better." And like explains all this stuff. And he says, "That's got to be expensive." And he said, "It's the cheapest drug there." And then later when he's on pills, he said, "They're pills, Dewey. It's the next logical progression for you."
I think a lot of credit has to go to John C. Reilly for
just,
this movie, too.
Yeah,
because he's the only guy that could like carry this all the way through.
And that's the other thing,
is
all of the songs in the movie, they weren't written by John C. Reilly by any means, but there's, I think, 7-8 songs in the movie, and they're all written and recorded by Reilly and that band, John C. Reilly and that band. And he even said I saw an interview during the making of the movie, he said, "If you told me how many songs there were going to be in this before I signed on, I probably wouldn't have done it." Because they had to learn from scratch 8 songs, 9 songs.
And because the movie came out at the end of the year, I remember it came out over a Christmas holiday season, which is the worst timing for a movie like this. I don't know why they did that.
Yeah, I don't
this
either.
Movie got 0 Oscar attention, and it should have been nominated for Best Song, at least.
Yeah.
There should have been something in there for that, and there wasn't even that, because the movie came out with all this heavy Oscar competition and just disappeared.
Just died. Yeah, I don't know. I think the
movie. Do you think that it's all right? Because both 40-Year-Old Virgin, 40-Year-Old Virgin and Knocked Up, both of them. You say heart. I would say both of those are overly sentimental.
Sure.
But because they're also oftentimes grotesquely funny, they make that sort of over sentimentality kind of acceptable to a more youthful, you know, movie going public.
Right.
Bro out to it.
Yeah, kind of. You know, even though it's about hugging and loving each other. I mean, they're very sentimental films. And it sounds like, because I've not seen Walk Hard. I kind of just skipped it. But it sounds like it actually is relatively understated but scathing satire.
Yeah,
there's a great
satirical streak that runs through it, because they hit the bullet points.
You would love it.
It sounds like
it is devoid of that sentimentality.
Mm-hmm. It is.
That,
it is.
And so if
and it mocks
except at the end when it's not earned.
It mocks that sentimentality and it's hilarious. Like,
awesome.
Because he plays like a induction ceremony. And that's hilarious. And then
it's the tacked-on ending that all these movies
and
always
have. He gets welcomed in by like Eddie Vedder, Lyle
so
Lovett,
and
Jewel
need to see this.
playing themselves.
And there's a million kids running around at the end, and he doesn't have any idea who they are.
He doesn't know who his
kids
are. He's got millions of kids. He has a Brian Wilson freakout segment that's hilarious. He has a Dylan phase where he like sings. He becomes the tallest midget. He sings all these songs about midgets. Like that becomes his
midget
social his social cause. I'm trying to think of the other big hilarious
I'm really glad
that
you brought this up.
He hosts
because of the Huntsman.
He hosts a variety show that's kind of like Sonny and Cher, and the shit that comes up during that is hilarious. Jane Lynch, before she was really recognized, she's the host of this interview show and just does a terrible job. I'm trying to think of other. The Beatles. He runs into the Beatles, and they're played by 4 actors that look nothing like the Beatles intentionally. So like. The closest one is Paul Rudd plays John, and then Paul Rudd plays John. Jason Schwartzman plays Ringo. Jack Black, though, is Paul McCartney.
Yes.
And then Justin Long is George. And their exchanges are hilarious. And and all of their accents are horrible, like intentionally really bad. And at one point, Jack Black says, "Of course, I remember when I wrote them. I'm the leader of the Beatles. Like, that's the way. And then the infighting between him and Paul are hilarious. There's a Yellow Submarine-influenced acid trip that's hilarious. There are just so many funny moments. They're just right on point. That's my favorite thing about it. It's like, if you're a fan of music, it's great. If you like satire, it's great. If you were burned out with biopics, because there were like four at that point. Two had been Oscar contenders in the same, or within a 16-month span.
Yeah.
And
Walk the Line and Ray.
Yeah, Walk the Line and Ray were both big. And this just came out and was so funny and didn't ever hit its audience.
I liked everything that it made fun of, as well as making fun of the things that I liked.
But that's what good satire does.
Yeah, because I love the Beach Boys. Yeah. I know you're crazy about the Beach Boys. And the way that they portrayed that is hilarious. And the Beach Boys song is really funny, too. And it's like when he's in the recording sessions and they're on take 300 and something and he has barnyard animals and he's trying to get them to behave. And it's a great movie. I love it.
I would have to quote Ian Faith, the manager for Spinal Tap, about this movie. When Rob Reiner asks him why the group is playing smaller theaters, he says, it's not that our popularity is waning, it's that our appeal is more selective. And I think that the appeal of Walk Hard is very selective, and that's probably why it died.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's mine. So that went over better than I thought it would. I wasn't sure how you came down on it. We've never talked about it before.
I liked it a lot.
Now I know. I guess I should have picked Your Highness just so we could have fought about it, but
I'm glad you didn't.
I don't have anything to really say except that it was funny, funny in points. So
we ended positively.
It did. Hooray! On a positive note.
It's the first time ever.
Yeah.
All right. Well, have a good Friday, everybody.
Yep.
Happy
we'll see
Friday.
You next week.